Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we're going to talk about companion planting, among other things, and attracting beneficial insects to your garden. Jessica Walliser is back with us, a horticulture and author, co-founder and of the popular website SavvyGardening.com. If you're not familiar with it, that the Savvy itself is spelled with two V's, S-A-V-V-Y, SavvyGardening.com. She's a two-time winner of the prestigious American Horticulture Society Book Award. One of her most popular books has been updated and re-released, I should say. And it's titled Attracting Beneficial Bugs to Your Garden, A Natural Approach to Pest Control. And it's a dandy book, I can tell you that. We're going to start by talking about bugs in the garden, but we can talk about other gardening topics as well with her. She's got a broad range of expertise. So I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments as we move along. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jessica Walliser, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. It's always a pleasure to join you. I appreciate the invitation, as always.
You originally published Attracting Beneficial Bugs in 2014, I believe. What needed to be updated for this new release?
Yeah, well, there was a couple things. One, I wanted to replace some of the photos. I felt like I had some better shots of some of the insects to help people identify, and also some shots of how beautiful the plants that support these insects can be. So we swapped out some of the garden images in the book to give folks a better idea of what this process of supporting beneficial insects in the garden can do for your garden in terms of making it more attractive. I also wanted to make some more cohesive links to the importance of native plants in our gardens to these beneficial predatory insects. So added a great interview with Doug Talamy about how native plants can support beneficials. And we actually removed one of the sections as well, because in going out and talking about how you can use beneficial insects to help manage pest control, I discovered that people weren't as interested in creating sort of a whole new insectary border garden, like a brand new garden to support them. Mm-hmm. Instead, what they wanted more of was, how do I do this in the garden that I already have, right? What are the plants that I choose? What kind of actions can I take to be a better supporter of these insects? And so we actually took out the chapter that talks about, formally designing this whole new garden dedicated to them. And instead, we really focused it on, what can you do with what you already have to make it a more welcoming environment? So yeah, those are just some of the changes.
It's a beauty. It's a beautiful book. In the introduction, you make a couple of confessions. Tell us about those and why you thought they needed to be said.
Yeah, well, I thought they needed to be said, first of all, because I want people to understand that I came from the same place that many gardeners come from, and that is from a place of loathing bugs, right? Of really feeling like they have no role in the garden, and any bug equals a bad bug. And, years ago when I started my career in horticulture, I came out of college with a background in ornamental horticulture that taught me what to spray to get rid of pests. And I think that's where a lot of home gardeners come from, right? We learn from our parents, you put the, pesticidal dust on your cabbage plants to keep the cabbage worms away, right? So I started from the same place that everybody or most people start from. And so I wanted to make that very clear. And then I wanted to sort of confess about my transition and that I was sort of, late in making that connection to how good bugs can really help you be a better organic gardener. I didn't like bugs at all at one point in my career. And then how the process of how I came to really love and appreciate them and understand the really important and valuable role that insects can play in our gardens.
Yeah, they play a huge role. We all, I think many people immediately think about pollinating, which is obviously. But what are some of the other things that good bugs do in a garden?
Yeah. So, and actually, you know, when you say to somebody, they talk about, you talk about beneficial insects, that's where their mind goes first, right? It goes to the native bees, the honeybee and the butterflies and all those amazing creatures. And they are one category of beneficial insects. But the category of beneficial that my book focuses on are the predatory and parasitoidal beneficial insects. So these are the natural enemies of many common garden pests. And they're basically the predators that feed on the prey insects in our garden, like the aphids and the mealybugs and the white flies and all of those quote-unquote bad guys. So this book focuses on that category of beneficial insects. And it's a very, very broad category. I mean, we are talking about tens of thousands of species of insects that play a positive role in helping us manage pests in the garden.
Yeah, it's amazing. Some people are going to say, "Well, I got a bug that's killing my garden, and it's an invasive, I think, and doesn't have any natural enemies. What the heck do I do then?"
Yeah, and that is one topic that I cover very, very clearly in the book, because I say, you know, we humans have messed an awful lot up, and the fact that we have imported, you know, these insects that are considered to be invasive, that are very aggressive, that have no natural cycle of predator and prey. They've got no system of checks and balances when they get here. And what do we do about that? And that would be, in my mind, the one instance where you might turn to a product control to manage them, because they can be so destructive. And it takes generations of insects for birds to recognize them as a food source, for predatory insects to recognize them as a food source. So I often use the example here in Pennsylvania of the brown marmorated stink bug.
Yeah.
And they've made their way to Wisconsin.
Oh,
I
yes.
Imagine. Yes. Okay. So they came to Pennsylvania first. Lucky us, right? We had them first here in PA. And what happened was, I mean, for the first probably 4 years that we had them, they would collect on the back of the house by just, you know, tens of thousands of brown marmorated stink bugs in the fall. And it was really problematic. And it was really about 3-4 years into that that gardeners started reporting that they were seeing birds eating these stink bugs, that they were seeing praying mantids eating the stink bugs, that frogs and salamanders and other living organisms out in our gardens were starting to eat them. And that's because there was a few generations in that now they recognize them as a food source. And now they're still awful, but they're not nearly as awful as they were before, because they are now recognized as a food source. So eventually they kind of fit their way somewhat into the food chain. But when they're brand new, these invasive introduced insects are extremely problematic.
Yeah. Our guest today is Jessica Walliser. We're talking with her on Garden Talk. We zeroed in a little on attracting beneficial bugs to your garden. That's the title of her book, one of her books. But we, of course, take other questions as well. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Fred from Normal, Nebraska. Fred, thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the show.
You bet.
So I have a question here. I have a geothermal greenhouse on my property here in Normal. I was wondering what kind of pests I should look for inside there. I have trouble getting more pests in and out because of it's mostly an indoor habitat. Do you have any?
Oh, we lost him, but he's. Fred's wondering what are some tips, maybe plant companion tips or other tips for that kind of situation.
Sure. In a closed environment of the greenhouse where temperatures are really moderated, it probably doesn't get below freezing in there, that can really be a haven for pests. So if you get, you know, one aphid that shows up into that environment or one spider mite, they're going to be able to breed really quickly and their life cycle is going to occur pretty quickly. So they can really, you can really get outbreaks there much more easily than you can, let's say, in an outdoor garden where you have a lot of native natural predators available, like ladybugs and lacewings and parasitic wasps and even birds, right, to help you manage those pests. In a greenhouse, closed environment, a little more challenging. I would do regular scouting trips. He asked, you know, how do you keep them in check? Number one, get a hand lens, walk through, regularly check your plants. Because in an indoor growing environment like that, you want to get a handle on things really early. The good thing about a closed environment like that is that's a perfect place to practice what's called biocontrol, which is where you are purposefully introducing certain species of beneficial insects into that greenhouse when you have a pest outbreak. So let's say you did have a spider mite outbreak on whatever plants you were growing in there. You could intentionally release some predatory mites, and there are many species of them, and I cover them in the book, that you can buy little packets of them, little sachets, and hang them on the infested plants, and the predatory mites will go out and help you control that spider mite problem. And that's just one example. There's, you know, if you have mealybugs on your plants, you can introduce a species of ladybug called the mealybug destroyer that you can buy from an insectary and release it into the greenhouse. It's much less effective to do that out in your garden, right? Because in an outdoor garden, they can, you know, those ladybugs can fly away, or those predatory mites, you know, they will not do quite as good of a job as they would do in the controlled environment of a greenhouse.
So that's a great idea. And you do have that information, a lot of that information in your book.
Yeah, there's a whole chapter that's dedicated to purchasing beneficials and what you want to do versus what you don't want to do. I typically don't recommend it, again, for outdoor environments because, you know, it's much better for you to do things in your garden that will naturally support your native population, your indigenous population of these pest-eating beneficials. Focus on supporting the ones you have versus buying and importing from an insectary, if that's at all possible. Again, different situation in a closed greenhouse, but in a home garden, that's what the focus should be on.
Fred, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jessica Walliser, our guest, her latest book, a reissue and a redoing of the book, Attracting Beneficial Bugs to Your Garden, A Natural Approach to Pest Control. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Trina LaSousa, our engineer today. You can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network and Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with Jessica Walliser, author of many books, including the one we're talking about now, a reissue of Attracting Beneficial Bugs to Your Garden, A Natural Approach to Pest Control. Quite a few changes in this new edition of the book, I think all for the better. And again, join in, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@WPR.org. Mike in Wonder Lakes, Illinois, emailed. He has slugs in his garden, a couple inches long, fat, very sticky, and he wonders if they're beneficial insects, and if not, should he try to get them out of his garden? He's noticed that they winter over under rocks and other objects, so now would be a good time to easily remove some of them.
Yeah, so these are not considered to be beneficial insects in sort of the term that we're talking about today. Obviously, all insects have a role to play in the ecosystem of the garden, whether that be, you know, their food for the birds or for, you know, they're a part of the food chain like that, or maybe they're pollinators or whatever. Slugs are decomposers. That's the role that they have to play. They decompose, eat, digest, and break down organic matter into the garden, but they also eat our plants. The unfortunate part is that all of the species, or almost all of the species of slugs that are here in North America that eat plants, were introduced. They are not native. Most of them are European species. So, you know, obviously there are some native species that eat plants, but the vast majority of the pest ones are not from around these parts. So what do we do to help keep them in check? There are some beneficial insects that we can attract that do eat slugs, and the primary one of those is a group of beetles known as ground beetles. And ground beetles, they live under the same rocks and logs that the slugs do, and they feed on them both as beetle larvae and as mature beetles. And in fact, there's a lot of research going on right now in the Pacific Northwest, in particular at OSU, about how do we attract and support ground beetles to help us control these damaging slugs. And what they found is that the ground beetles really like the habitat of sort of these bunch grasses, which are like native. We often think of them as ornamental grasses, but native grasses that grow in sort of like a clump. So it might be switchgrass, panicum, or some of our native prairie grasses that grow in a clump, like side oats, grama, and things like that. And that makes great habitat for ground beetles. So there are these things that you can build. They're called beetle bumps, which is basically like a raised circular area in the middle of your vegetable garden or out just outside of your vegetable garden that you plant with these bunch grasses, and you leave it unmowed, and it becomes a habitat for these ground beetles during the day. And then at night, they go out into your garden and they eat pests, including slugs. They like to eat larvae of asparagus beetles, Mexican bean beetle larvae. So they kind of climb up into the plants and eat all of these pests at night. So that's something, if you have a lot of slugs, you might want to consider doing that.
That's pretty cool. And that's also attractive.
It is. It's pretty. Normally, we would leave those bunch grasses stand. You can cut them down in the spring and then allow, just to get that sort of dead growth out of there and allow them to grow. And it does create a really nice environment. You can even mix in some flowering native plants in with those bunch grasses because they certainly won't hurt. They will create habitat for other beneficial insects and provide nectar to things like ladybugs and lacewings, which can go further to help you control pests.
That's pretty cool. Mike, thanks for that question. Joanne in Key Wascom will go to you now. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I have a question that I'm sure you've received a million times about Japanese beetles. I garden organically, and I have been just picking them off and putting them in soapy water, but I've got so many beetles, and I know some people use the traps, which I've heard attract more, but I grow pole beans, so obviously I can't get them all off the top of the beans. So is there any other way to do it? And how harmful are the traps?
And let me ask you, Joanne, too, how long has this been a problem? How many years? Do you know? Sorry, I didn't hear you.
3 to 4 years.
3 to 4 years, okay.
And they don't just go on they go on they like basil, they like hibiscus, they even go on ornamental grasses.
Yeah.
They just go on a ton of things.
Yeah, Japanese beetles have a list of about 300 plants that they regularly feed on in our landscapes, and that's both, edible plants, so food crops for us, like your beans or my blueberries, and then also ornamental plants, like your ornamental grasses and shrubs and perennials and things like that. So they can be very problematic, and that is an example of a pest that was introduced that does not belong here, and that it only now, after being introduced in the 60s, it now sort of does have some semblance of a group of predators that will eat them. The robber flies are one that will. They have some parasites that affect them, and they also actually have a fungus that will affect them as well. So like any pest, they are actually best targeted when they're in their larval state, which is the grubs that feed on your lawn, the roots of your lawn. So I always suggest to people apply parasitic beneficial nematodes to their lawn. And nematodes are like a little microscopic roundworm that you buy as a powder and you mix it in with water in a hose end sprayer and spray them over your lawn. And they tunnel down into your grass, and then they kill the Japanese beetle larva in your lawn without harming any of the good insects. So that's one option. Now, that's tough. If you live in a neighborhood and nobody else is treating their lawns organically for grubs, obviously their Japanese beetle adults are going to fly over to your yard. So in that case, you do also have to manage them as adults. And what I always recommend that people do, and what I do in my own garden, is I use floating row cover. So on the tops of those bean plants, you can drape some floating row cover over there, or like bridal tulle, which is like the netting that you use to make your bridal veil. You can buy that really inexpensively at the fabric store and drape that over the tops of the plants. Now, obviously, you have to remove it to let pollinators pollinate the flowers. But if it's even just over the tops of the plants where you can't reach to do the hand picking, that will help cut down on the numbers of them. Some years are going to be better than others. Some years I have terrible Japanese beetles on my blueberries, and they have to go under floating row cover. Other years, they're not nearly as problematic. It really tends to be quite cyclical.
It does, and we've noticed that, just as you were talking about earlier, the Japanese beetles tend to be really bad the first many years, four or five years at least, and then they tend to cut back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've noticed that in my own garden, as a matter of fact, but had them terribly in the beginning. They love grapes. I don't see nearly, I mean, I just see a few now.
Yeah, and it really seems that the research that I've read on them over the years is that they're gregarious feeders. So they, when the first few emerge in late June or early July, when the first few adults emerge and they find a host plant, as they're feeding on that host plant, they actually release a pheromone that is attractive to other Japanese beetles. It basically serves as a signal like, hey, come on over here. There's some really good food, right? And so that's why you get these big clusters of them on your plants to feed and often to breed as well that way. So if you can make sure that when you see the first few Japanese beetles, you get rid of them immediately, that prevents them from obviously releasing that hormone, and that can really make a big difference in which plants are attacked and how many of the beetles show up. And she mentioned the traps as well.
Yes.
I think it was the University of Tennessee that did the research on those Japanese beetle traps, and they're pheromone based traps. So they're using a pheromone to kind of lure them into the bag, but they can lure in from a very far distance. So if you're going to use those, I suggest that you put them way far away, like maybe at your neighbor's house or way far away from your garden, like 500 feet from your garden, so that they won't draw, you know, don't put it in your garden or they're going to draw more beetles there. Put it somewhere far away from the garden.
Yep, good points. Joanne, thanks again. Ellen in Madison, we turn to you now. Hi, Ellen.
Yeah, hi. We have Japanese beetles on a rose bush, sometimes just overwhelming numbers. Last year wasn't too bad, but I like the idea of adding the floating row covers, and I'm just wondering what would be the best moment in time to apply that.
Hmm.
Yeah,
and you've got roses you're worried about, Ellen. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I would do it as soon as you notice them. As soon as you notice the first ones in your garden is the time to cover them. We grow plants like roses for their beautiful flowers, and it is a shame to have to cover them, with a floating row cover or a piece of bridal tulle. But at the same point, if you're really protecting the health of that plant, and they do really only need to be in place for about 3 weeks, because that's about as long as the Japanese beetle adult life cycle takes, 3 to 4 weeks. And then you can remove it and enjoy the flowers, you know, both before that and after that time period as well. You're protecting it primarily through the main high pressure season of Japanese beetles.
Ellen, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Somebody was wondering, how do you figure out what bugs you have in your garden and if they're good or bad?
That's a very good question. Well, I think the first thing I would say is that it's important to realize that there's about 1 million identified insect species on the planet right now. At least twice as many that we haven't identified yet, but there's about 1 million that have been identified. Of that million, actually less than 1% of that million have been classified as known agricultural or human pests. So it's actually a very small percentage of all the insects out there that are considered to be harmful. The vast majority of them are either benign or they're beneficial for us and for our garden. So don't automatically assume that a bug that you see in your garden is going to be a bad guy. So you gotta do a little bit of research and get a good book, get a good resource that can help you identify those insects. There's a lot of great apps that you can get on your phone where, like iNaturalist, all you have to do is take a picture of the bug and upload it to the app, and it will give you an identification on it. So there's, you know, Google searches. Google is great for searching to help you identify a pest. For example, you find a bug on your kale and you're not really sure and it's making holes. It's definitely eating the kale. What do? Well, you type in the description of the insect and that it's feeding on your kale into Google and then look at the pictures that comes up, and that can help you identify those pests as well. And that's really important because you don't want to automatically try to control something that might be actually doing good for your garden. So it's really important that you properly ID before you take any actions in the landscape.
And I'd also mention the University of Wisconsin Insect Diagnostic Lab. PJ Leash is the head person there at the lab. And if you go to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab website and send him a picture of the insect, he can usually give you a pretty quick answer as to what the insect is and what harm it may or may not be doing. Maybe it's beneficial.
Yeah, it's very rare that people like that who make their lives out of insects, it's really hard to stump them, especially with things that you commonly find in the garden. It's pretty, they probably see a lot of the same insects over and over again. So that's an excellent resource. You're very, very lucky to have that.
Mm. Matt in Middleton, we go to you now. Hi, Matt.
Hello. I'm a smaller vegetable grower in Dane County. We grow about 15 acres, and we've had problems with Japanese beetles. And I used to use row cover a lot because I tried to avoid spraying. And at the end of the season, when I looked at the amount of waste as far as row cover was concerned, we eventually gave it up after we saw a dumpster full of row cover. We just decided that looking for more biodegradable insecticides was better for the planet in the long run. And for Japanese beetles in particular, we have found a product called Evergreen, which on the organic side would be Pyganic, but it has a synergist mixed into it that prevents the insects from being able to metabolize the insecticide as quickly. And we don't necessarily spray it to kill the Japanese beetles, although it will stun them. What it does have is a repellency effect for 3 to 4 days. So for items like berries, we grow a lot of raspberries. We'll spray berries in the evening when the pollinators are not present, and that will have a repellency effect long enough for us to go in and harvest the majority of the crop there. There's no pre-harvest interval restrictions with it, and it's essentially a chrysanthemum extract. So we found that has been a significant improvement over the large amount of waste that comes from row cover. There's no more cost with it, and there's no more disposal, no more plastics in the environment.
Yeah, especially when you're looking at 15 acres. That's a lot of acreage to have to put row covers on.
It is, yeah. I mean, having had an organic market farm in years previous, I ran a 20-acre organic market farm, and I feel your pain. That is a huge amount of space to manage. Two things I'd like to say with that and address with that is, for home gardeners, row covers can be used for many, many years, especially if you buy high-quality brands of it. Some of the lower quality, really lightweight versions of it do tear very easily in winds or even when you're trying to secure it in place. And if you're covering huge rows like he is and on his farm, it can, obviously be destroyed a little bit more quickly. But for home gardeners, it's not as much of a worry. I've had mine now for probably 6 or 7 years. I fold it up at the end of the season, put it in our shed. You can wash it out really easily in a bucket of soapy water. So it is, you know, obviously a little more of a sustainable choice for home gardeners than it is for a large commercial farm like that. Pyganic is a pyrethrin-based pesticide. Yes, they are certified for use on organic farms, pyrethrin-based pesticides, at least the natural ones. The synthetic ones are not, but the natural ones are. I do caution, though, I'm hesitant with that, and here's why. Because the pyrethrin base is basically a nerve poison, and it's an instant kill for a lot of insects, especially a lot of types of pollinators, but also things like our parasitic wasps, tachinid flies, hoverflies, and other good beneficial insects that help us control pests. So there's a lot of collateral damage with those kinds of products, even though they seem like they are good because they have label, you know, organic on the label, or they're OMRI certified or whatever. There's always a downside, and there's always collateral damage with them. So for home gardeners, I don't necessarily think they're a really good choice. I think with a commercial farmer, I mean, that's your living. So I think it might be a different story and worth investigating. But for home gardeners, I just would caution people to be really, really careful.
Yeah. Matt, thanks again. Appreciate your call very much. Ann in Germantown, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ann.
Hi. My question is, what do I do about little larvae in raspberries?
Little larvae, and what do they look like?
Like very small maggots.
Okay.
And it's in your raspberries and not your blueberries, right?
Raspberries, sure. Inside the fruit.
Okay. So there are a number of beetles that can lay. There's one called the raspberry beetle, as a matter of fact, that can lay eggs on your raspberries, which then hatch into larvae, and they feed in the fruit. And sometimes they make the berries all shrunken looking, and sometimes you just happen to come across them when you're eating the berries, right? It's so unfortunate. There's different species that can attack blueberries as well. So that's another case where, for me, floating row cover is a great option. Once the bees have visited the flowers in your raspberry patch and the raspberries have started to develop, so the flowers are no longer in active bloom, the berry set has just begun, get that floating row cover over the plant, and that will help, you know, that will prevent, form a barrier to prevent the adults from laying eggs in those berries.
And how long would you keep that row cover on for a situation like raspberries?
Oh, I would say probably until you're ready to harvest. You know, I would keep it on and then maybe just sort of peel it back, make your harvests, and then put it back on again. I know some people that actually build sort of like a wooden frame over their plants that will support the row cover, and that makes it a little bit easier to, take it off to harvest and then put it back on again at the end. And certainly it has helped in my blueberry patch a great bit with both the fruit borers and the Japanese beetles, just covering them with that floating row cover.
Annie, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Kathy emailed, they have encouraged birds to help keep their vegetable garden pests in control by providing birds with posts for perching. They came to this practice by watching the bluebirds perch on a fork that was standing in her garden for digging potatoes. They would perch, then fly down and pick up a bug over and over. They no longer have cabbage worms, and they are taking care of the birds.
I love that. And that is a great reason to also, you know, hang bird houses up and around your vegetable garden. At my house, it's the Jenny Wrens, or my grandmother called them Jenny Wrens, but the little house wrens. I have a bunch of wren boxes in my backyard, and I love sitting on the back patio and watching them hop over the tops of the broccoli and cabbage plants and pick off the cabbage worms and fly back to the nest box and feed them to their young. It's fabulous. Chickadees will do the same thing. If you read Dr. Talamy's Bringing Nature Home, he talks about how each brood of chickadees requires about 3,000 caterpillars to raise, for the parents to raise the brood to maturity. And that's a lot of caterpillars. And if that's right there in your vegetable garden, man, that can make a huge dent in the problematic caterpillars in your veggie patch.
Very cool. Kathy, thanks for that email. Nancy in Nina emailed that late this past summer she had an infestation of skunks digging up her lawn and her flower beds for grubs. Her neighbors don't have the problem because probably they continuously treat their lawns with herbicides and pesticides. Nancy would like to prevent the problem next year but doesn't want to chemically treat her lawn. Any suggestions for a natural solution to grubs in lawns and gardens?
Yep, I talked about that earlier.
The
beneficial nematodes. You can even buy them on Amazon. Just make sure you're getting a species that's labeled for Japanese beetle grubs. Real easy to mix it with water according to the label instructions, and then you use a hose end sprayer and spray it over the lawn. And you would want to do this. They're not winter hardy up in Wisconsin or even for us here in Pennsylvania, so you need to do it every spring. But they're not super expensive. It's super easy to apply. And it's really, really quite effective, more so than I think some of the other organic controls for beetle grubs in the lawn are. So that's I highly recommend it.
Nancy, again, thanks for that email. Jessica Walliser, our guest today, horticulturist and author. Her latest book is called Attracting Beneficial Bugs to Your Garden, A Natural Approach to Pest Control. Questions, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jessica Walliser, with us, horticulturist and author of 7 books. And she has a re-release and with a lot of changes to her book, Attracting Beneficial Bugs to Your Garden, A Natural Approach to Pest Control. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments about your garden. Maybe it has to do with bugs. Maybe it has to do with some other aspect of the garden and what you're growing. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@WPR.org. Let's take an email. Valerie in Eau Claire emailed that squash beetles are the bane of her existence. They have destroyed her squash crop for 2 straight years. She used a frost fabric for floating row covers, which protects them until she needs to trellis them due to size, and wonders if you have some other help for her.
Yes. Okay, so I'd like to first share my sympathies, because squash bugs are, in fact, incredibly problematic in most gardens, and I feel for her because my garden is no different. They are resistant to a lot of different pesticides, and one of the reasons is they have a piercing, sucking mouth part like an aphid does. So it's a little needle-like mouth part that punctures the leaf and sucks out the sap. They're not like caterpillars that take big bites out of leaves, and when they take big bites out of leaves, they can then ingest any, you know, if you use an organic pesticide. That doesn't work with squash bugs because they don't consume plants in the same way. And that's one of the reasons why they're so problematic. The row cover does work, and that, of course, would be my first suggestion for a line of defense. But there's other things that you can do as well. One of my favorite things, and I actually have a video that went viral a couple of years ago on social media, of me going out into my squash patch with a piece of duct tape wrapped around my hand with the sticky side facing out. And what I do is every few days I go out to my squash patch with this duct tape on my hand, sticky side out, and I look through my squash patch and I look for their very distinctive egg clusters. They're sort of bronze colored, they're shaped like little footballs, and they're usually laid in clusters on the leaf undersides, occasionally on the leaf tops as well. And I use that sticky side of the duct tape to collect the squash bug eggs. And I can fill up an entire handful of squash bug eggs every few days by going out into my garden. You can also collect the nymphs, the little tiny immature squash bugs, with a piece of tape like that. And then I just throw the tape away in the garbage, or, you know, put it away in a, throw it away in a plastic bag or something like that. So it's a very, very easy way. It's much easier than going out and trying to capture the adult insects or the nymphs by hand, because those little suckers are fast. It's better to get them as eggs. So that's one way. The other way is the adults. I haven't done this in a couple of years because the duct tape is really effective, but there is a bait that you can use for them, and it is molasses mixed with water 50-50, and then a little bit of apple cider vinegar in there, and you put that in like you would for a slug. So you put it in a real shallow bowl and then sink the bowl down into the ground right near a developing squash fruit, because they love to sort of cluster on the developing fruit. And they get drawn to that, and the apple cider vinegar kind of ferments out there, and then they kind of fall in and they drown. And it works very well as well. I stopped using it because it also sometimes can catch other insects that are, again, that collateral damage. But that might be an effective control for protecting the fruits themselves from the damage.
I like that tape idea, though. That's a really good one, for
it's
sure.
It's spectacular, and it's so easy to do. You know, their eggs really stand out. They're really distinctive, and it's clear what you're, you know, that you're getting squash bug eggs, and it's just a really effective way to do it.
Let's take another call. William in Jefferson, your turn. Hi, William.
Hello. I'm calling asking about the Japanese beetles. My brother's had a lot of success with traps. He actually expanded the size of the traps and put some downwind to keep them from, you know, being attracted to particular places in his yard. But the question is, what do we do with the carcasses once we've, you know, collected them and drowned them? Can they be spread in a field? Can they be composted? You know, can they be used to, you know, in some way limit the other beetles? Are they even, you know, can you even use them as a compost?
Yeah, you can throw them in your compost pile for sure, as long as they're, you know, dead all the way, or you can bury them. I know some gardeners that do that. They bury, you know, just kind of dig a hole somewhere out in the landscape and bury them in there. I know people that just sort of dump them into the woods. There used to be sort of these tales of farmers and gardeners, you know, putting them in a blender with water and then respraying them on the plants, saying that that would deter the Japanese beetles. But there's actually, they've done some research on that, and there's no scientific evidence that it actually works. So I wouldn't ruin a perfectly good blender by putting Japanese beetle carcasses into it. I would just go ahead and throw them on the compost pile or bury them.
Thanks for that call. Appreciate it. Grace in Bailey's Harbor emailed, lily beetles invaded a couple of years ago, and they've wiped out almost all of her oriental and tiger lilies. What can she use to get rid of these guys?
Yeah, those red lily beetles, man, they're such a bugger. And if it's not the adult ones, it's the larval ones, because they're equally as destructive. And these are not insects that go for, you know, day lilies. These are true lilies. They attract, you know, the Asiatic lilies and the Oriental lilies, the true lilies. They are an introduced exotic pest. So again, here we are, a situation where there's very few natural enemies that will prey upon them because they're not a recognized food source. Hand picking is definitely an effective control measure for them, but that does involve you going out to your garden every few days, learning what the larvae, learning what the adults look like, learning what the eggs look like, and then squishing or collecting any ones that you happen to find. That will help cut down on their populations. They are, you know, if you feel like you have to spray, and I always even hate to recommend sprays, but with the lily beetle, again, not having any predators, this is a case where it might be warranted. And I would use one of the spinosad-based sprays, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. There's a couple different brands, but probably the most common one is Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew. And spinosad is a product that's made from a fermented soil bacterium that was actually discovered outside of a rum factory, oddly enough, in the Caribbean. But they isolated this bacteria. They found it has insecticidal properties. And you can buy this product and spray it on the lily foliage targeted. You only want to get it on the foliage because it can be harmful to pollinators. So do it in the morning or in the late evening after, you know, when the pollinators are not active, and make sure that you target only on that lily foliage. And that should help you gain control if the hand picking doesn't work.
Let's take another call. Kathy in Glendale, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, pesticides is on my mind. Where I live, the front and side lawns of my house, it's just open, so the neighbor's lawn merges into mine. Every spring, I eat dandelion greens from my lawn because both neighbors have never used chemicals, and the house is for sale on one side. I also eat hosta shoots from my front lawn. If that new neighbor starts using pesticides or chemicals, how many feet away do I have to be worried about? So, in terms of continuing to eat my dandelions and hostas.
That's a great question. I mean, I think it in part depends on what type of product they're using. You know, is it an herbicide? Is it a pesticide? Is it a fungicide? Is it chemical fertilizers? So I would ask some questions for sure about what it is that they're applying. Some things are more problematic than others in terms of ingesting. I would certainly, if it were me, I would certainly say not harvest anything probably within, you know, a week to 10 days of them applying anything on their lawn. And I would try to probably say, you know, maybe 5 to 8 feet. This is just my opinion. That's not like some scientific research that I read. But I'm saying if it were me, I would not eat anything that was at least 5 to 8 feet away, and certainly not within that 7 to 10 days of them applying any products. And then I'd have a nice conversation with them where I would try not to be judgy, and I would try to understand where they were coming from, and maybe try to also change their mind about using the products in the first place.
I was thinking about talking to the current owners and maybe asking them what they've done to not have to use chemicals at all, and that information could be passed on to the new owners.
Great idea. Great idea. Yeah. Yep.
That'd be a really good positive way to do it, so that they knew before they even moved in, practically, that here's how this person took care of this good lawn. Yeah. So there you go. Some advice, Kathy. Thank you so much. Brian in Soldiers Grove. Hi, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I've got a question regarding how to control or eliminate squash vine borers and striped cucumber beetles. They always come into the garden here and wreak havoc on our vining crops. And I've tried BT, the specific type of BT for those type of pests, as well as hanging yellow milk jugs that I read a university did a study on, that were, the milk jugs were painted yellow with holes and soapy water inside to attract them, and to no avail. They wrecked our squash and our cucumbers and melons again this year.
Yep, again, sympathize totally with you on this front. Squash vine borers, you know, that's kind of an easy one to control, actually, and you're going to be like, oh, man, why didn't I think of that when I tell you this? But squash vine borer, you know, the female vine borer is a day-flying moth, and it looks a little bit like a wasp, but it's not. It's a moth. And she lays her eggs. Her first place that she likes to lay them is right at the base of the plant, right where it meets the soil, because that's the most vulnerable part of the plant. So that's where she likes to lay her eggs. So if you can protect that point on the plant from very early in the season and have a barrier there so that she can't access that site to lay her eggs, that will go a long way towards helping your plants and helping them produce for a lot longer. So you can do this by wrapping the whole base of the stem in a long strip of aluminum foil and wrap it, you know, fairly loosely so that as the vine grows and expands, that piece of aluminum foil can grow and expand as well. You can also do this with like a nylon stocking, like a pair of nylons, right? You can wrap those around the stem of the squash plant. And, you know, if you cut a slit up the side, that will allow the leaves to develop off the side. And that puts a barrier there to keep that squash vine borer adult from laying her eggs on the plant. So I do personally do the aluminum foil wrap every year on my squash. I start way down at the base of the plant and I spiral it up the stem, and I can kind of go around the leaves, and I just continue to wrap it as the plant continues to grow, and it works like a charm. For the cucumber beetles, you know, the damage that the main negative damage that they cause is on the seedlings of the cucumbers. That's where they can do the most damage. So protecting young cucumber plants with floating row cover until the point where they come into flower is really critical for reducing that extra damaging damage that they cause to those seedlings. So keeping the plants covered. The issue we face when the plants are mature with cucumber beetles is the fact that they spread bacterial wilt. They are the vector for that. So you need to choose bacterial wilt resistant varieties to plant.
Brian, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jessica Walliser, our guest today. She is a horticulturist and author. Her latest book is called, it's a reissue of Attracting Beneficial Bugs to Your Garden, A Natural Approach to Pest Control. And it's a reissue, but a lot of updates in it. So one certainly worth taking a look at. If you have the original version of it, you might want to get this new one. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Our guest today, Jessica Walliser, horticulturist and author and co-founder of the popular website SavvyGardening.com. And her book, Attracting Beneficial Bugs to Your Garden, A Natural Approach to Pest Control, has just been re-released and updated. So we'll talk with her about bugs that can be a problem for you or not. And we'll take other gardening questions as well, for sure. So what would you like to hear, maybe about some new plants to try this season or questions about selecting grow lights for inside? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Jessica, before we go back to the phones, I want to go to an email. A number of listeners have emailed to ask if you have any experience with jumping worms. And we certainly have that experience here in Wisconsin, some parts at least.
Yeah, you know what? I do not have any personal experience with them. I have not encountered them in my garden, but I certainly have heard from plenty of gardeners that have had issues with them. And or have noticed them in their garden. So I don't know that I'm the best person to provide advice for that. And I'm not sure that there's anything that can be done at this point to control them other than not moving your garden soil from one location to another, which can obviously impact the rate at which they're spreading. So, yeah, it's unfortunate. Another invasive, right?
Yeah, another invasive. Mary in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Hi. Good morning. I discovered last summer that the my cranberry viburnum was getting chewed up. So I looked it up online, and it looks like it's viburnum leaf beetles. Mm-hmm. Well, at that point, it was too late to do a lot with it, and I'm wondering if there's really any way to deal with it or if I need to just get rid of the plants. Well, I mean, and if I did, would I be able to get another viburnum, or should I try something that's not a viburnum? You know, have you seen people have any success with this sort of thing, with viburnum leaf beetles?
Yeah, viburnum leaf beetles, I mean, they're just terrible. And the cranberry viburnums are one of the most susceptible species. Basically, not all species of viburnum are susceptible, and so I would suggest that you choose, one of the more resistant species, and I think probably like the Korean spice viburnum, I think the double file viburnum, those species are more resistant, and they're less welcoming to the pest. So if this were my garden, I would say you know, swap out that American cranberry bush viburnum for one of the species that's a little bit more resistant. But otherwise, it's going to be an uphill and continual battle, and it's just one that, in my opinion, is not worth fighting when there's so many other fantastic viburnum species out there that aren't affected by the beetle.
And would you repeat those two again, the two that you mentioned?
Sure. As being resistant, the Korean spice viburnum, which is Viburnum carlisii, in the double file viburnum, which is Viburnum placatum. And then I think there's some that are sort of like marginally susceptible, so that they're definitely less susceptible than the cranberry bush ones. And that would be like the black haw viburnum, which is Viburnum prunifolium. And I think also on that list of moderately would be the Birkwoods, which are Viburnum birkwoodii. I think those are really decently resistant as well.
And Mary, thank you very much for that question. Appreciate it. Let's see. Kevin in Sheboygan Falls emailed to say he wants to use marigolds to help with pest control this year. And he wonders what variety of marigolds can he start from seed for transplanting into his garden or yard area? And what would you recommend for marigold planting density?
So marigolds are fantastic plants. They're wonderful for their blooms, for their interestingly fragrant foliage. There's not a whole lot of scientific evidence behind them that they can actually deter pests. There was one study that they that was done where they did discover that they help with onion maggots. They help deter onion maggots when you interplant them with your onions. But as far as them being like an exceptional companion plant for deterring pests, they're really not high on the list. The book that I had come out last year, which was my most recent, aside from this new re-release, is called Plant Partners. And that's about how to use science-based companion planting to help actually really deter pests in your garden. And it's all based on actual university or agricultural center research. So I would recommend picking up maybe a copy of Plant Partners and seeing if there's some other choices. But if you're going to plant marigolds just for the sake of gorgeous, fantastic marigolds, by all means, I love that idea. I love the gem marigolds, the signet gem marigolds, which are the ones with the teeny tiny little blooms and the ferny-like foliage. Those are my absolute favorite. Those are ones I plant in my garden the most.
Yep, they're a pretty plant for sure, but maybe not so beneficial when it comes to a problem with insects or dealing with it. Andrea in Madison emailed, the little worms are, she's referring to something, the spotted winged drosophila fly.
Mm-hmm.
Was a big problem raspberry. 2 years ago and hurt, and this goes back to the raspberries.
Yeah.
She controlled it by cleaning all debris from her garden over winter, or maybe the weather did it. They overwinter in the soil.
Yeah, and that's funny because I'm glad that she actually brought that up, because when I was talking about the raspberry beetle and the larva of the beetle being inside of the berries, I should have also mentioned this, the spotted drosophila, which is a type of fruit fly, right? And they also can lay eggs in the raspberries. So I would encourage the original caller to really maybe get some pictures of those little wrigglers inside of there and actually get a proper ID to determine whether it's the beetle or the fly that is creating the larva that's causing the problem.
Yeah, and again, the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, go online to that. You could send a picture right straight to PJ Leash and get a pretty quick answer for sure. Well, Barbara called to remind us that Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection has a landscape pesticide registry, and it allows Wisconsin residents to be notified 12 hours before commercial pesticide applications are applied to neighboring landscapes. And you need to sign up for that before February 1. So there's not a lot of time, but I would say, if you would like to do that, you can go to the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection for Wisconsin. And that landscape pesticide registry. You can sign up for that, and then you will be notified 12 hours before commercial pesticide applications are applied to neighboring landscapes. So another good piece of information there. And by the way, you can join in too. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Dan in Menominee Falls emailed, he grows lots of brassicas and wonders if you can recommend a companion plant or plants that would attract beneficial insects.
Ah, yes, I absolutely can. I have a long list to go with brassicas. Number one, anything in the Apiaceae family, which is the carrot family. And these are things like dill and cilantro and angelica that have blooms that are shaped like a like an umbrella shape, like clusters of little tiny flowers that are in that umbrella shape, like all that those plants I just mentioned, because those little tiny flowers are very, very attractive to many species of beneficials, including parasitic wasps, that can help control cabbage worms and other pests of cabbage and brassica, other brassica plants. So those, that's top-notch companion planting to help deter pests and help attract beneficials into any type of brassica crop. The other thing you can interplant with it as well is any member of the daisy family or Asteraceae. This would be things like Coreopsis, like cosmos, like sunflowers and Shasta daisies, right? Anything with sort of that daisy-like flower structure. Again, at the center of each one of those flowers are hundreds of tiny little flowers, all of which provide nectar for many of the species of beneficials that help prey on pests of brassicas. So those would just be two groups of plants that make excellent partners.
You know, maybe we could talk a little bit more about your book. I mean, you mentioned some parts of it, but maybe for those listening in, could you describe the book for those who don't have a copy of the original, and really even those who have a copy of the original are probably going to want to get a copy of your new book.
Sure. So Attracting Beneficial Bugs to Your Garden. Again, the original one was 2014, just come out as a new edition, and it really introduces how we can use beneficial predatory insects to help manage pests in our garden. So it's how do we create an environment in our vegetable gardens and in our flower gardens that is very supportive of the thousands of species of good bugs that eat the thousands of species of bad bugs. And so the beginning of the book actually just sort of talks about my own journey to coming to appreciate beneficial bugs. And then also it introduces the insects themselves. There's a lot of profiles in there of, you know, what does a parasitic wasp look like? How does it work? How does it help you control the pest? What about ladybugs? Did you know that there's 480 different species of ladybugs in North America? Here's what they look like. Here's how they work. And there's, I think like 30 or 40 different groups of beneficial insects that represent tens of thousands of species that are featured in the book. And then there's also plant profiles in there. So what are the best plants that you want to include in your landscape that can provide nectar and pollen and egg-laying sites and habitat for these good beneficial insects? How do we incorporate them into our gardens or around our gardens to help support these really good insects? And then also I do talk about, you know, whether or not you should purchase beneficial insects and, you know, should you really buy those ladybugs on the container of the garden center? You know, the short answer is definitely not. But in the book, I go into a myriad of reasons why you don't want to do that and what you can do instead. And then there's a section on other actions that we can take beyond planting the right plants in our landscape that can help support these beneficial insects and create a more diverse garden, which is things like don't cut your garden down in the fall. Don't clean up every fallen leaf. Instead, when you do that, you're taking away the overwintering habitat for all of these amazing insects that help you control pests. So it talks about how to manage the landscape in a way that is very supportive to these little critters that can be so very helpful to us.
Yeah, dandy book for sure. Dan in Viroqua, we'll go to you now. Thank you for calling, Dan. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon. I have some seeds from a native Wisconsin shrub called the bladder nut, and I'm wondering if the guest has any tips on how to germinate them.
Ooh, that is a really, really good question. American bladder nut, I don't know. I've never grown them. I'm not a plant propagator, so I would say do a little bit of research. I would maybe contact your cooperative extension agent there or someone that is particularly knowledgeable about Wisconsin native plants.
Bladder nut, yeah, and I don't it's not one that I could feel like I could comment on either, unfortunately. But, yeah, a quick call or email to your horticulture agent in your county, I think would probably be appropriate, and that person will be more than happy to, if they don't know themselves, they'll be more than happy to let you know who would be able to help you out. Sir, we can't help on that one. Becky in Pine River emailed. She wanted to share her experience with controlling squash bugs. Her crops have been devastated until she used this method, and she hasn't had any problems since. When she plants squash, pumpkins, cucumbers, zucchini, or any of those types of vining plants, she plants 9 to 12 radish seeds in the hill with the seeds or transplants. She lets the radish plants grow right along with the vines and allows them to bloom and go to seed. Have you ever heard of that, Jessica?
That's interesting. That's an interesting combination. And certainly in, again, my previous book, which is called Plant Partners, which is about companion planting, I do talk quite a bit about some studies that were done on radishes and their ability to serve as a trap crop, where especially for flea beetles, where if you grow them in conjunction with, say, your tomato or your pepper seedlings, that the flea beetles are more likely to feed on the radish than they are on the tomato seedling. And so they can be used as a trap crop like that. I didn't come across any research about growing them and allowing them to go to flower in terms of squash bugs. But I would say to Becky, it's sure as heck not hurting anything. And if it's working for you, go ahead and give it a try and continue to do it. It's not like it's, you know, you're trying anything that's dangerous or anything like that. You know, is it something that I personally have experience with or can personally recommend because there's some bit of research that points to it? No, but that doesn't mean that it, you know, wouldn't work. So you might as well give it a try.
Why not? Thank you very much for that, Becky. Appreciate it very much. So, thinking about this, what beneficial insects really get a bad rap from gardeners?
I would say probably two groups of them, and number one would be the spiders. People are so sort of innately terrified of them, when in fact there's very, very few that are actually dangerous to us as humans. Most of them have mouth parts that are not even actually capable of either opening wide enough to pierce human skin or puncturing human skin. So obviously, there certainly are some, but most of them are far more interested in feeding on the various pests in our garden. And there's been some incredible studies that look at the amount of nocturnal pest predation that takes place when spiders are around and by spiders. And it's pretty spectacular. Like corn, they did a study on a cornfield. And when spiders were present, they looked at who was preying on the corn earworm larva. They found that 70% of the predation that was taking place was because of spiders. So even though you're not seeing them work because you're probably not out in your gardens at night, spiders, hunting spiders in particular, which are the ones that crawl along the surface of the soil, play a huge role in predation. So number one would be those. Number two would probably be the parasitic wasps. You know, we hear the word wasp and we automatically think of some scary, dangerous thing that's out to get us and sting us, but again, we're talking about tens of thousands of species of wasps who, you know, are incapable of stinging humans, and instead they're focused on laying their eggs inside of other insects. And, you know, the tomato hornworm is a classic one that is preyed upon by parasitic wasps. But there are many, many, almost every species of pest has at least one species of parasitic wasp that uses it to house and feed their developing young. So it's a very broad, very diverse group of insects that play a significantly beneficial role in our garden. So we need to just sort of get over the fact the word wasp is in their name and know how beneficial they are. And some of them are so tiny. They're like smaller than a gnat. They're only big enough to lay an egg in the back of an aphid. That's how tiny they are.
I want to mention, too, and I mentioned it sort of in passing earlier in the show, but your website, I think, is a really good one, savvygardening.com. And again, I'll mention savvy is spelled S-A-V-V-Y, so two V's in there, savvygardening.com. Talk about that for a minute. I bet you get a lot of traffic on it.
We do, yeah. We're very, very fortunate. You know, we have maybe 10, well, last year we had, because of COVID, everybody was really into gardening, so I think it was 12 million visitors in the course of the year last year. So it's a great resource. We've worked really, really hard. It's myself and two other garden writers, professional garden writers, horticulturists, and it's our mission to sort of make gardening approachable and welcoming to everybody and really provide a wonderful free informational source to gardeners on everything from houseplants to garden pests to how to plan your garden to, you know, ornamental plants to DIY, you know, building your own sort of tomato cages and things like that. So we want to encompass a wide variety of gardening techniques. We go really in depth in the articles, and we have a lot of fun doing it too. You know, we do have some videos up on there and have a broad range of topics covered on the site.
And I think you can order your book on there, your books on there too, can't you?
You can. Yep. You can go to the tab, buy our books, click on that, and then that will take you to the buy pages for each one of the books. Mm-hmm. But every one of our books, and all three of the people that contribute, all three of us that contribute to Savvy Gardening have authored multiple books, and all of our books are available at every book retailer out there. Bookshop.org, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and your independent local bookseller as well.
Yeah, I'm sure you're readily available. I just went online to your site, though, and it was kind of fun because here we got an article on growing artichokes from seed to harvest. Here's another one on fishbone cactus care, and here's another one on butterfly houseplants, how to provide food for young caterpillars. There's a lot in here.
It is. It's the butterfly host plant one. That was it's a wonderful article by my business partner there, Tara Nolan, who's a garden writer in Toronto, Canada. And she had a great time diving into, you know, which host plants are best for butterflies. Yep.
Well,
lots of topics.
It's been, as always, it's just been a delight talking with you today, Jessica. I really appreciate it. And I hope we have a chance to do this again. Will you come back, be with us again?
Anytime you'd like, Larry. It's always such a pleasure. Always have a good time. And you have such very thoughtful listeners.
Yeah.
To call and email with such wonderful, wonderful questions. And the diversity of questions is always fantastic to see. You must have a lot of green thumbs in Wisconsin.
Lots of smart people in this state and lots of good gardeners. Jessica, thanks again. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry. Take care.
Jessica Wallace, her new book is reissued and updated, Attracting Beneficial Bugs to Your Garden, A Natural Approach to Pest Control. Isn't she a lot of fun? It's been great talking with her. Monday at 11, we'll take a look at why we're seeing such rapid increases in meat prices. Then at 11:45, we'll talk about using a slow cooker like a pro would use it. That's Monday on the Ideas Network. But you know what? In the meantime, there's lots more good things in store right through the afternoon, and I hope you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.